Has it ever occurred to you that you're just as much a prisoner as I am?
Oh, my dear chap, of course, I know too much. We're both lifers. I am definitely an optimist. That's why it doesn't matter who number one is. It doesn't matter which side runs the village.
It's run by one side or the other.
Oh, certainly. But both sides are becoming identical. What, in fact, has been created? An international community. A perfect blueprint for world order. When the sides facing each other suddenly realize that they're looking into a mirror, they will see that this is the pattern for the future.
The whole earth as the village.
That is my hope. What's yours?
I'd like to be the first man on the moon.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Party Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is the former Communities Minister and Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour, in the Mark of the Beast, and it's British, who said UK manufacturing was dead. The COVID pass. This is the thing that which will allow you to do everything you used to do once you've had a vaccine. Who's funding it? And is this Blair and Brown's ID card's second wave, which we campaigned against with the No to ID starting in 2004, we thought was finally killed off in 2010? The COVID pass is what one venture capitalist, Sir Ronald Cohen, thinks we all need. He's a Labour Party Blairite funder. And he says the cost to governments of his COVID pass to let us back into pubs and etc. will be very small compared to the $350 billion lost every month to manufacturing in the US alone. Plus the vaccines, the great TV debate we still haven't seen yet between Bill Gates and the British anti-vaccine physician, the discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Certainly that would be an interesting TV show. We don't have that, but the second best, which is the latest part of a documentary series from California called The Truth About Vaccines. I'm always suspicious of anything that's saying the truth about anything, but let's see what they've got to say. And a cameo appearance from our very own Dr. Wakefield on the health risks of the COVID-19 vaccine as he sees it from California, asking if we've learned anything at all, he says provocatively, from the Nazi experiments on humans. And Meng Wanzhou, remember her? China's Huawei chief financial officer, currently under house arrest in Vancouver, Canada. She was arrested 18 months ago in December 2018 under American orders. Every time the US moves closer to extraditing her, China, it seems, moves closer to Hong Kong and against Hong Kongers and also America's allies in the region. And perhaps related are troop movements we've seen this week in Asia, in India and China, as well as China's mission to Mars and America's privatization of space between here and the moon by Elon Musk. What's going on in space? That's all in the second hour after six. So joining me to review this week's news, it's the former Communities Minister and Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the Politics Show Online.
First time we've done this over Skype, I think.
It is, and well done for getting it installed so quickly. I think you're an absolute master at IT. I might have to call you now for any of my problems on my computer.
No, I wouldn't do that if that was you.
No. Okay, maybe we'll pass on that one. Anyway, we've got some big stuff to talk about going on in the city this week, particularly with the merchant venturers and also with Bristol Energy. But I've got to ask you, you were Communities Minister for a while, weren't you? I mean, how did you find that job actually suddenly being propelled up to Westminster as a minister? Was it very much like, you have a lot of these Sir Humphreys nagging you and trying to manipulate you?
Yes, absolutely. You're surrounded by them in the Department of Communities and Local Government, or Housing, Communities and Local Government, as it's now called. It's actually the largest in government. It's enormous. There's the biggest team of ministers and a huge team of civil servants. So there were a lot of people to work with, and it was quite a steep learning curve just getting to know who does what and what the department did, let alone what I was going to be doing myself.
Did you ever feel outmaneuvered by them? Because they're almost like the permanent government, aren't you? You're just a passerby.
I used to think that was true, and you still hear it, and you've just said it, but actually the conclusion I came to was that that isn't true, and often ministers last longer than the officials who advise them, particularly at a high level. I mean, we've all heard of the fast stream and the mandarins and so on. Many of them only actually spend 6 months or a bit longer in a policy area, and then they move on and learn something else. So quite often I would find that I was in a meeting with someone, I think I'd met this guy before, and it was 6 months ago, he was an expert on race equality, and now he's talking to me about local government finance. And of course, after a while, you realise you know rather more than they think you do, and they're not as smart as they might appear to be.
I mean, it might sound a trite comment, but did they ever actually say to you, yes, minister, when really they meant no minister?
Yes, I don't think it was on the first day. I think it was on the second day that somebody did say, yes, minister. And I just sort of smirked internally, thinking, yeah, I can tick that off in life now. Someone has actually said that to me. They never say no, minister, but they have a variety of other phrases to try and talk you out of something. I remember this may sound quite odd, that we were doing a big exercise on housing standards. And I was in charge of that. And one of the things I tried to insert into it at the end, which would have made me very popular with all postmen and everyone who delivers, was that we would have letterboxes in a standard size and in at least the central part of a front door. And this was the housing standards review. We looked at everything from room sizes to window design and whatever. So it was a perfectly valid thing to bring up. And they refused to let me do it because it hadn't been consulted on. So. And I think that's a shame. I pushed the point. And ironically, it is now happening. So a few years down the line, after I left office, that is actually going to come in. And you'll save a lot of postmen from a lot of back injuries and problems. And, of course, political deliverers as well.
And maybe getting their fingers bitten by terriers as they put a letter through a very low down postbox. But also, I mean, you were in that department, weren't you, in the run-up to the Grenfell Tower fire, and a lot of criticism has been levelled at you, Stephen, saying that you actually blocked the examination of cladding of buildings. And in fact, I remember being sent some stuff at the time saying, gosh, Stephen Williams has not really done his job here, because there was an attempt by the lobby groups, including, as I understand, the London Fire Brigade and people like that, to get a proper investigation done before the Grenfell fire of the cladding standards and how flammable it was, and you blocked it.
Well, first of all, Tony, I have to say to you, there's an inquiry taking place and it hasn't concluded yet. My evidence to that inquiry was given in, I think it was July 2018. So we're now some time down the track from that. I don't know when they're going to report. Obviously, their hearings have been held up because of, for the same reason everything else has been held up at the moment. Virtually everything you just said then was false. Other people may have said it, but people say a lot of things about you when you're in public life, and they're not all true. Often they have an axe to grind when they say it, and some of the things you just said there were factually incorrect. But I can't go into it, and it's pretty unfair of you to bring that up at the head of what I thought was an interview about all sorts of other things, when you know there is a public inquiry taking place.
Well, that's okay.
Every single minister since 1997 as part of that inquiry, and none of us can say anything about it.
Okay, well, that's fine if you don't want to say that's actually fine, Steve.
There is a legal process in place.
Okay, well, anyway, I believe there are one or two newspaper articles out there, so I'll just put a link up to those on our show page. You're quite free, as far as I'm concerned, Stephen, you're quite free to counter anything I said or correct the record if you wish.
Well, I've said what I've said.
Okay, well, let's move on to look at Bristol Energy now, because we've seen a rather extraordinary event this week, which is on Tuesday, an extraordinary meeting at the City Council looking at this horrific record, really, of this company. I mean, it's actually quite difficult going through all the articles looking at how much money Bristol City Council, of our taxpayers, council taxpayers' money, has gone into this. It's £35 million now, Stephen. And the headlines this week are all saying, well, the City Council is now blocking an inquiry into this. So is it OK for various mayors, including Ferguson and Marvin Rees, to be pouring vast amounts of money, now £35 million, into this company, and not to have to explain why.
Well, no, it isn't. Quite obviously, it isn't. I mean, that meeting that took place earlier this week on Tuesday of the City Council, which, of course, like this conversation, was a virtual meeting rather than a face meeting, meant that Labour councillors were pressing their buttons to block an inquiry. And I think it was defeated by 34 votes to 32 votes, and all of those 34 votes were Labour councillors. So they've clearly got something to hide, or they're trying to protect the reputation of their Labour mayor, Marvin Rees, who might have something to hide. And the big problem with Bristol Energy, it's a company that's clearly lost its way. I mean, it was originally thought of by the Liberal Democrat administration, in fact, on Bristol City Council about 8 years ago, I think. And it was meant to be a company that would make renewable energy in Bristol, you know, from turbines at Avonmouth, from having photovoltaic panels on the roof of council buildings and council flats and so on, and sell that renewable energy to the people of Bristol. And so it would be a sort of virtual circular economy within inside the city. How it's actually been implemented by Marvin Rees is something utterly different. It's simply a small player in the retail energy market buying electricity on the markets and trying to sell it at a margin. And of course, they're competing with all sorts of people there. And I'm not sure that's something the local authority should be involved in. And as you say, it's ended up costing Bristol taxpayers, everyone who pays council tax, everyone who pays business rates in the city. I think it's 37 million is the only certain figure we know at the moment has been poured into it in terms of share capital. And there's probably quite a lot of other millions on top of that in other support that the city's given to it. But they won't disclose it. And they've used their majority on the council to stop it all being revealed.
Well, this is extraordinary stuff, Martin. I mean, this is a sort of private venture. I would imagine, I mean, it was started, of course, under George Ferguson, the previous mayor. So it's quite surprising that Labour should want to block an inquiry, since most of the blame will probably go on Ferguson and not Marvin Rees, the Labour mayor now.
Well, I don't really know enough about this to have a very strong opinion. But, of course, I agree with what Stephen said earlier. I mean, there's no way that you're going to compete with the oligopoly that was created by privatisation under the Tories a long time ago. You know, it smacks to me of this kind of green tokenism. I mean, ultimately, what you've probably got to do, and as a socialist, I'd say this, you've got to renationalise the energy industry rather than create competition within a completely rigged market.
The Bristol's mayor, Marvin Rees, Labour mayor, said that the previous administration had created the company, as I just said, and he added that they had the party and we've been left to cope with the hangover. Earlier this month, City Council announced it would be putting the firm up for sale. So, Stephen, is this a viable business that the council might actually be able to get a few bob back for?
That's a question that's impossible to answer, of course, because the facts and figures are not on the table for councillors to see, let alone for the rest of us who are not among the 70 councillors on the City Council to have a look at. The major firm of auditors and consultants, Ernst & Young, were appointed by the council, we do know this, to have a look at the finances of the company and see if it was a viable entity for sale or just to carry on trading. And, of course, we don't know what their conclusions were. I think a small number of people around Marvin Rees and other councillors do know what they are, but they're not allowed to say. So I don't know, you don't know. And it's an absurd situation when tens of millions of pounds have been put into this company. Other millions may have been added to the known figure at a time when we know local government budgets have been cut, at a time when we know because of the public health emergency that we're in at the moment, that local government budgets have been stretched even more than anybody thought to pour probably north of 45 million, I would guess, into a retail company is quite extraordinary, particularly for a Labour council to be doing.
It is. It's absolutely incredible. I think there is, of course, there'll be calls for quite a while for an independent inquiry now. also going on saying, well, it's not much point in the council looking into it if they don't they're trying to block this, and they've succeeded now in blocking it. There needs to be an independent inquiry. That's what the opposition in the city is saying. Stephen, do you think there will be any proper explanation of what's happened here?
I think the truth usually comes out eventually. But of course, it was a Liberal Democrat Conservative motion before the council on Tuesday that called for such an independent inquiry. And that's what was defeated by Labour, using their very narrow majority of councillors to vote it down. And we've known for 2 or 3 years at least that financial problems at Bristol Energy were only getting worse, and it was going to suck more and more resources out of the council, which therefore means that those resources weren't available for public services. I'm guessing that Marvin Rees and the Labour Party were desperate to push this issue beyond the elections that should have taken place just a few weeks ago. Now that those elections have been deferred because of COVID, they're going to find it pretty difficult to keep stringing this out for several months off into the future. So
that's an interesting point.
We're at a crash, and then we will know about it, or it will be offered for sale, and probably for a knockdown price, because they have a customer list, but I'm not sure what other assets they would have.
It's an interesting point, Stephen, you make there. So you're saying that at this meeting, if there had been an election, this might have been the point at which it all came out. But now the Labour group and the mayor have been rather wrong-footed by not having an election, so they've got to put a lid on it.
Absolutely. I mean, they've been desperately holding down the lid on a pretty smelly can for quite a long time, and I think at some point that lid's going to ping off.
Yes. I mean, the other aspect of this, of course, is that this was created in a time, I think, maybe by looking up at Stroud and in other parts of the country. Stroud's Ecotricity, very successful, has done something similar to this, sort of as a middleman between the people that buy electricity, the domestic customers, and the electricity companies. But, I mean, we're a long way down the line now, and the margins, you've got to be a very big player in this market now to make any money at all.
Absolutely, and this is something the council really shouldn't, as I said at the start, should never have gone down this road. The original mission of the company was to provide green and sustainable energy for the people of Bristol, generated in Bristol. That was the original idea, not for it to become sort of market player against the large companies that your friend mentioned, but also that if people want to go to shop around for their tariffs, and we know some people do this roughly every quarter, and there are websites that can help you do it. There are other players who got far more experience in this than the city council, who's Ecotricity you just mentioned, right in Bristol. Of course, we've got OVO, located just by Temple Meads, a major employer in the city. This is their market. Why on earth the city council thought they wanted to compete with them is beyond me.
Before we finish on Bristol Energy, Martin, it'd be really nice to hear what your thoughts are about the whole privatisation of the electricity market in the first place.
Well, the market should never have been privatised in the way that it has. What's happened, and of course the shares were very popular, but you've just created an oligopolistic situation. That is to say, you've got a number of very large players. And they engage in things like confusion marketing, so that it's impossible for people to know from month to month what the cheapest deals are. And of course, it was based on this ideology that people have got the time to go out and constantly check on the websites about who's giving the cheapest prices. It's a sort of market ideology that led to it. And of course, previously, you know, you'd had the Southwest Electricity Board or whatever it was, and they worked under very strict controls on profits, and, you know, cutting people off who were vulnerable and so on. And of course,
But it seems to me that you've got a completely different skill set necessary for running utilities to sort of venture capitalist companies. So, you know, when you're running a utility, you don't really have to do anything. You just sit there and watch the money roll in, and you're not innovating. So that does seem like this is easy money for people that really should be out there in the commercial sector innovating, doing something different and something new.
Well, the market structure is often determined by technology. So you could see the case for the privatisation of British Telecom, as the telecommunications industry was revolutionised by digital technology. But things like supplying water and electricity and so on, the technology hasn't really moved on that much since the 19th century. And the scale of it was what led to it being in the first place municipalised, so that it would basically, the energy companies would be run by big city governments, and then ultimately nationalised, because that was the logical thing to do with it. But of course, in the 80s, we forgot all of this and decided to reinvent the wheel.
The other thing is, Stephen, that if I'm an investor, say in Southwest Energy or whoever, one of these big energy providers, whether it's gas or electricity, I can invest in my gas and electricity, say something like £20,000 if I've got it hanging around, and I never really have to pay a bill again because my electricity bills are paid by my dividend or my share deposit. So, you know, you've got a situation which enables really the wealthy simply not to have to pay anything for their gas and electricity.
Yes, I suppose that's broadly correct. And I think just for once, Martin and I probably agree on this, that this is an odd area for there to be market competition when everyone wants to pay a fair price for their energy. And it seems to me at the moment what's being created is, if you're well informed and are willing to invest the time, you can get a good deal on your energy. If you just want to get on with life and assume that you're not being ripped off, then you probably are being ripped off by these large companies. And this is, again, comes back to the problem with Bristol Energy. They're competing in the edges of the market where people are constantly shopping around for a different supplier. They might be with OVO for one quarter and Ecotricity for the next quarter, Southern Electric for the next quarter, and then maybe Bristol Energy for the next 3 months. That's a very volatile market with huge churn in the customer base. And if you're not doing anything else, like producing energy or selling products that are ancillary to energy, you're exposing yourself to huge risk. And this is where Bristol Energy, I think, has been caught out, or the people who've been running Bristol Energy have been caught out.
Stephen, have you got anything more to say about the secrecy? Because this means that there is very little information about why the continual amounts of tens of millions of pounds of our Bristol taxpayers' money has been going into this over the last 4 or 5 years.
I think there's two things I'd add to that. First of all, is there is a problem with the way Bristol is run now. When we got directly elected mayor back in 2012, I was marginally in favour of it at the time because I thought it would be good for the city to have a clear leader, not just inside Bristol itself, but on the national and world stage as well. We don't need that anymore because we now have a network of regional mayors. We have a West of England mayor and a West Midlands mayor, Greater Manchester mayor and so on. So that part of it is no longer necessary. So you're left with a directly elected service provider. The problem with the current holder of that post, Marvin Rees, is that he doesn't seem to be terribly interested in the services that his city provides to people. And I think he's taken his eye off the ball when it comes to Bristol Energy. So that exposes a political problem there.
OK, so let's have a look now at another story, which is the woman called Marty Burgess of West Indian heritage is becoming the first merchant venture of West Indian Heritage, an organisation which has been at the heart of Bristol's life, says the Bristol Post. Their business and education for centuries has appointed its first ever black member. Bristol solicitor Marty Burgess has joined the merchant venturers and said she did so after taking some time to think about whether she should accept the invitation. Now, Marty has said that she wants to try and change the merchant venturers from within, Stephen. Now, do you think she'll manage that?
Well, good luck to her, and congratulations to Marty on being accepted into Bristol's...
Hang on, being invited? I mean, you can't apply to join, can you?
No, I think... Well, I don't know, to be honest. I've certainly not been invited to join. I think you have to have quite a lot of money to join it. And of course, Marty Burgess, though she's a solicitor, I think her family have quite a lot of property in Bristol, and they're connected with what was the Lakota nightclub on Stokes Croft. So I guess that's how she qualifies under their rules for being allowed in. Whether she can change them from inside, I really don't know. I've certainly watched this organization, as I know you have, over a long period of time, going right back to when I was a councillor in the 1990s. And to be fair to them, I think they have changed. I think they were a very secretive society that just sat on a lot of investments. We didn't really know what they did with their money. We didn't know that it was being spent in the best interests of Bristol at large. But in the last 10 or 15 years or so, they have got involved in helping to run state schools in Bristol, as well as the private schools that they were previously connected with. And I think they have made a difference. I visited Merchants Academy in Withywood a few months ago with the Lord Mayor. And you know that's a venture where they've tried to turn around educational standards in a part of the city that had been struggling for decades with them. So I think they have been doing some good things in recent times, but obviously their history and the connection to the slave trade is very dark indeed.
Yeah, it's quite brave of her to join the former slave traders, really. But I mean, there's a similar problem, isn't there? You touched on it there, Stephen, and that is of transparency. Merchant venturers do not file any accounts at Companies House. It's really impossible for journalists to scrutinise, more importantly, maybe, where they're putting their investments, where their money is being invested. I mean, it could be, and it probably is, in all sorts of unethical areas, including things like the arms trade. But unless you're a privy councillor, and you institute an inquiry because they're constituted under a royal charter from 600 years or so ago, then you have no idea how much money they've got or where they're investing it.
Yes, I think that's probably the case. I think they do have to file some details with Companies House because they have various trading arms and investment arms, and but all we'll know there is sort of headline numbers. You won't know any of the detail. That is certainly true.
Martin,
they're a sort of a hybrid commercial organisation charity, and that's a bit. It's not just an issue with them. It's an issue with all sorts of structures around the country as to how much you know about where they're investing. If they were fully sort of public limited company, you would be able to ask more. Shareholders could ask questions at annual general meetings of the company. They're simply not structured in that way.
Well, Dr. Evan Jones from Bristol University's Cabot Project was on our programme a couple of years ago, Martin, wasn't he? And he was explaining that actually the merchant venturers were also the people who financed John Cabot's trip to the United States, even though they weren't constituted. It was the same families a few years before. And once they discovered North America, then they formed the merchant venturers as part of a way to exploit it. So this is a very powerful organisation, certainly very wealthy, but almost unaccountable. And the other thing probably to mention about the merchants is the structure does seem like a Masonic. Well, it certainly echoes a Masonic hall or Masonic lodge structure, where you've got the master, and he is basically, you know, number one top general field marshal in chief. But he's only there for a year. And then you have a warden who is the senior warden is next year's master, and a junior warden is going to be master in 2 years' time. So they have a way of sort of, I mean, this is identical to a Masonic system. And of course, the Masons are very known for their secrecy. So it's hardly surprising that we know very little about how much wealth they've got, where they got it from, and where they're investing it now.
Well, that's right. I mean, I must admit, I don't know much about them any more than anybody else does. Although I do know a bit about their involvement in schools, because I've recently worked in two schools that they've been they've taken over. And I think we've had Christine Townsend on this program not recently, but she's been on several times, who's an ex-teacher who campaigns around educational issues in the city. And there are issues, for example, around Colston Girls School, which was a private school and then became an academy, a state academy, but without changing the admissions policy, so that basically posh parents who used to pay for their girls to go there basically had the state pick up the tab, but they didn't really change the admissions policy so that local girls from around St Paul's, where it's based, find it virtually impossible to get in. Meanwhile, people are coming on the train from South Gloss, from very leafy, comfortable places into Bristol to go to the school. And, these issues around fairness and access and admissions policy, and also, of course, the fact that they've failed several Ofsteds at Withywood, that Stephen's mentioned. And what would happen normally is another academy chain would take over if you've failed an Ofsted. But they seem to have sufficient clout to prevent that from happening.
Anyway,
and they've also got sufficient clout to have Princess Anne come along to the school I was working with in Barton Hill before Christmas, and I don't suppose she goes everywhere.
No, so Marty Burgess could find turning round the Matthew a bit more like turning round the Titanic. We shall see. Best of luck to her. But we've also got this week, we've also heard from central government, from Boris Johnson, that now up to six people from Monday are going to be allowed to meet in England for the first time for several months. So let's have a listen now to Boris Johnson announcing that yesterday.
So from Monday, we will allow up to six people to meet outside, provided those from different households continue strictly to observe social distancing rules by staying 2 metres apart. At the moment, as you know, people can meet in parks, but not in private gardens. And this was a cautious first step. But we know that there is no difference in the health risk. So we will now allow people to meet in gardens and other private outdoor spaces. These changes mean that friends and family can start to meet their loved ones, perhaps seeing both parents at once or both grandparents at once. And I know that for many people this will be a long-awaited and joyful moment. I cannot and will not throw away all the gains we have made together. And so the changes we are making are limited and cautious. It's thanks to the caution we've shown so far that all five tests are being met. And that's not my achievement or the government's achievement. It is your achievement. It's only possible thanks to your resolve and dedication to our national purpose to overcome this virus.
Well, that's Boris Johnson announcing that up to six people are allowed to meet outside as of Monday. So generally, slowly but surely, the lockdown seems to be being relaxed. When I was out and about yesterday, it looks to me as if it's almost back to normal on the motorways, Stephen. Is it almost over now, do you think?
I've got that impression as well. I mean, since the lockdown started, I've become a keener cyclist than I ever was before. I mean, my chosen form of exercise always used to be swimming or going to the gym. And obviously, that's not been possible since roughly March the 20th. So I've taken to going out on my bike. And to begin with, it was actually quite pleasant because the weather was warming up and the roads were virtually empty. Certainly side streets, you could ride around perfectly safely. Just in the last week or so, I've noticed that some roads are just almost back to normal, as you say. That there are lots and lots of vehicles about. There's lots of people on the pavements as well. And it looks as though the public has moved rather faster than the government says they ought to be. And who can blame them? Because the government itself has sent out such a mixed message over the last few weeks about what's allowed and what isn't allowed and who can get away with some things and who cannot get away with things. But I think people are, to some extent, making their own judgments. And you don't want people doing that in a public health emergency. You want the advice to be scientifically based, evidence-based, to be clear, and you need everyone to follow it. And I think Boris Johnson and the people around him have rather undermined that basis.
Well, I'm going to, not out of any kind of trying to censorship here, but we've had 6 days of Dominic Cummings dominating the headlines, 144 hours of, you know, rolling news. One thing I would like to bring out, though, Martin, I think you pointed this out too, and this was that Craig Murray pointed out, the former ambassador, that there could have been an ulterior motive in Dominic Cummings' trip to Barnard Castle.
Well, yes, I mean, what he's pointed out is that GKN have got a factory up there, and of course they're bidding to be providing...
Hang on, let's just correct you. It's GSK,
GSK, sorry. Yeah, but they've got a factory up there and they're bidding to produce vaccines. And, you know, the suggestion... But what Craig Murray said was, this is possible, but I'm not saying it's necessarily the case. Don't forget that what Cummings himself said was that he was testing his eyesight, which is, of course, completely incompatible with the highway code. You're supposed to be able to see a number plate at 25 metres, aren't you, before you get in a car. So it may be that he was covering up for another, a business visit, if you like. But I think that, that is an interesting straw in the wind, but it's no more than that.
Emily Maitlis apparently was replaced as Newsnight presenter this week after her remarks stating as fact that Cummings definitely broke the lockdown rules, whereas actually most people seem to be saying, well, that is in doubt. She was stating it as fact, and then the next night she disappeared from Newsnight. Anyway, what do you make of this in a nutshell, Steve?
I think Cummings obviously has an extraordinary hold over the Prime Minister. I mean, Boris Johnson is officially the Prime Minister. He's leader of the Conservative Party. But you wonder just how much actual power he has inside Number 10 Downing Street. And don't forget, Dominic Cummings is, I think, the only person to have been found in contempt of Parliament in hundreds of years because of his refusal to give evidence about his behaviour during the referendum in 2016. He was actually found to be in contempt of Parliament, which ought to be quite a serious thing, and you would have thought would be something that would be terminal for anybody's career in public life. Yet, but here he is, the Prime Minister's right-hand man, and it seems as though he can do no wrong.
Also, there's lots to talk about with the virus, but one of the things that shocked me was I'm so glad that some of these SAGE, this is the government's, basically their pandemic committee, that they're being published and that they're more transparent than Bristol City Council is about Bristol Energy. Because one of the things in the SAGE report, one of them from April, actually states there that they will use the media to increase the sense of personal threat. So that is the idea there that, whatever the personal threats are, that it's a good idea, and this is government policy, to actually ramp them up to scare people. Now, there's an ethical issue here for us as journalists, as should we really be doing things like that? And I certainly think there are vulnerable people out there who could become absolutely petrified if they're seeing stuff in the media which is simply being used to wind people up and make them more afraid. So, Stephen, what do you make of this? It's the actual quote is, we will use the media to increase the sense of personal threat. That's what the SAGE is saying.
Well, as I said earlier, if you've got a public health problem, you have to, in order to combat it, you have to get clear information out there and to get everyone to understand that they might need to change their behaviour, or everyone in a certain group may need to change their behaviour, whether it's smoking or whether it's practicing safe sex. If you think of the various public information campaigns around public health that we will have been familiar with in the last 20 or 30 years, but they've got to be trustworthy. And I think that's what's been sacrificed in the COVID public health emergency. I think initially everyone understood that this was a terrible thing and we would have to drastically alter our behaviour in order to hold it in check. But that's been seriously undermined in the last 10 days. And not only do people now have a reason to doubt anything the government says about what's necessary to hold back COVID, they might actually start to doubt anything else the government says that is necessary in public health, like whether it's to do with your diet or to do with your respiratory health or drink driving, whatever it might be. And I think undermining of trust in politics is one of the most corrosive things that we've all witnessed in the last few decades. It used to be the case that people would broadly trust major institutions in the country, whether it was Parliament or the BBC, which you've just mentioned in the context of Emily Maitlis, or journalism in general. And I think all of those areas have had a huge erosion of trust in recent decades. It's quite hard to see how that can be repaired.
It is, isn't it? You probably find it difficult to decide whether you trusted politicians or journalists less these days. I think you're right, Stephen. Anyway,
both, of course.
What about the clapping for the NHS that's been happening every Thursday? That's now finished. So let's have a listen now to the last big clap for the National Health Service. And this is a report from Five News on it.
It's a weekly ritual up and down the country. Thursday nights, on the streets, outside homes and hospitals, as the nation applauds the NHS. But after 10 weeks, is it now time for the clapping to stop? While health workers appreciate the support, some say it's now time to focus on what the NHS really needs.
It's becoming quite politicised. We're seeing a lot of MPs sticking on their social media, then clapping outside buildings. And whilst that's lovely, I want our politicians to be focusing on the important things that actually matter to carers. I want them to be addressing the fact that half of care workers don't get a real living wage. I want them to be looking at the fact that just under half of doctors have had to provide their own PPE or rely on donations. These are the sort of things we need to be talking about.
The government says it's considering how best to reward key workers. On this London street, they've been clapping every week. And though they understand the frustrations, most are reluctant to give it up.
We come out on our doorsteps and not only can we hear each other clapping, we can hear London clapping. And I'd be all in favour of carrying on.
Well, I think the clapping has to end at some point, but I think we need to keep applauding the NHS.
And I think it's important to carry on. I don't think this is over yet.
Maybe as we come out of this, we will all feel how incredibly lucky we are to have such an incredible, not just an amazing National Health Service, but amazing people with such dedication. So I would clap every Thursday for the rest of my life, personally.
It's connected communities and shown health workers that we care. And though the streets may soon fall silent, the sacrifice they've made will never be forgotten. Leila Hayes, 5 News.
So that's a 5 News report on the end of the weekly Thursday clapping sessions. But at the same time, Stephen, we are hearing a new scandal really is developing, and I'd be really interested to hear your thoughts on this. And it's the massive number of people who have been dying over the normal, who have no symptoms or anything in England and Wales of coronavirus. The headline is almost 13,000 unexplained deaths in England and Wales since coronavirus crisis began, figures are showing. Fears grow that thousands died of non-virus causes at home or in care homes because they could not access medical treatment. Now, it's all very well cheering for the NHS, but we've had 13,000 extra people because they couldn't get treated because of the new arrangements due to the pandemic.
Yes, and I think that pattern will increase in the year or 2 years ahead, because a lot of people who might, for instance, have been going for scans if they were susceptible to a particular illness, bowel cancer, breast cancer, cervical cancer, and so on, in most parts of the country, certainly in Bristol, those scans have been stopped and have been stopped now for a couple of months. It's going to take quite a long time to get those back on track. So that means clinicians may have missed something. As we know, when you're dealing with cancer or any other serious illness, time is absolutely essential. And if things occur early enough, people's lives can be saved, or at least their life expectancy prolonged. So I think there'll be probably quite a lot of excess deaths. Is an awful phrase, but it is the official phrase that everyone who works in health understands. There'll be quite a lot of excess deaths from what might otherwise have been treatable conditions over the next couple of years. There are also people who will be having difficulty with managing conditions at the moment as well, who might have been due to go for treatment, and that's been stopped. I happen to be one of those. I have a neurological condition. I have injections roughly every 3 months in the neurology department at Southmead Hospital, but that treatment was stopped right at the start of this process. So that means I'm having difficulty at the moment controlling some of my muscle movements, and I have no idea when that treatment's going to resume. And there'll be lots of people with similar sort of conditions who have had that experience. So while it's right at the moment, I suppose, to focus directly on the people who've had COVID and have died, there are a lot of other health outcomes that are going to be very, very bad for people that aren't realised at the moment. And I think that's going to be an issue that people really are going to look at very carefully over the next few months.
Martin, what do you make of this 13,000 extra deaths, not COVID related? This is an enormous number of people. It's probably something like a third of the number of people who have died with COVID-19 on their death certificate. So not necessarily of COVID-19, but with COVID-19. A third of those, the total, are actually on top of all of this, have died of other causes because of the lack of general health care.
Well, I think some people are pointing this out and saying, well, that means that lockdown was wrong. And therefore, you know, for example, more people died from the knock-on effects of the lockdown than from...
Well, I don't think anyone's saying that, but there's a considerable number.
Yeah, but at the same, I think you've got to recognise that if you didn't have a lockdown, the deaths from COVID would be far higher. So, people have got to recognise that. I think the fundamentals, which most people, I think, have got by now, is they didn't lock down soon enough. And I fear that they're coming out of lockdown too soon because it's actually driven by politics and not by scientific advice. And I think that's pretty clear. And I think what we've seen in the last week is a massive sea change in many elderly conservative voters suddenly realising that they are expendable to the basically toffs who run the party.
Well, they better make sure that they don't have contact with anyone, although they won't be able to vote against the Conservatives at the next election. This is where we are, I'm afraid. I mean, it sounds callous, but anyway, look, let's have a look at the US now, because there's been this horrific thing this week with a guy called George Floyd, who was killed by police leaning on his neck, and the video is shown all around the world. But, you know, this is horrific, really, isn't it? And I wonder, Stephen, if you have any thoughts on the messages that sends around the world. I mean, the governor of Minnesota has been on the TV, and I have to say I find his manner extremely unconvincing and rather patronising. I don't think he sounds at all sincere as he's saying, oh, yes, well, this is a terrible thing and we're going to make sure it never happens again. Yes, he's sacked these policemen responsible for this, but none of them have been charged with murder.
Yes, I mean, from what I saw on screen, sacking should have been immediate, but also arrest for grievous bodily harm and leading to death should have followed pretty shortly afterwards. I've not heard what the governor of Minnesota said. I did hear what the mayor of Minneapolis, the city concerned, said, and I thought he was spot on, saying that this was completely unacceptable. I think part of this comes back to the culture of policing and life in general in America is just so different, not just to us in Britain, but just in Europe as well, that the mentality that everyone is free to carry a gun pretty much sort of clouds the minds of people.
But I mean, surely, Stephen, at least the mentality is the same. It's the weapons that are different.
I don't think mentality is the same. In this country, for police officers to use force, whenever force is used, whether it's with a firearm or whether it's with pepper spray, whatever, there are always follow-up investigations done into whether that was proportionate, whether it was the right thing to do. And we are lucky in this country, whatever people might think of the police on other measures, we're very lucky in this country that broadly we don't live in fear of what a police officer might do to us, depending on where we're from, what we look like or whatever. But in America, that is quite different. I think the gun culture is all part of it, that the respect for the value of human life must surely be lower in your mind if you know you can shoot at people because they didn't stop their car in time or they're refusing to wind down their car.
I mean, surely we have a similar culture of impunity here. Stephen, surely we have a similar culture of impunity here when the police are engaged in, for example, the shooting of Mark Duggan in London. I mean, there are many, many cases. In fact, there are films about it over here. Police are never jailed.
They're isolated cases, though. That's the distinction I'm trying to draw, that whenever there is a case of wrongful use of force in this country, there is a full inquiry afterwards, and we all know about it. and they are not routine events. Whereas in America, incidents like this seem to be fairly routine, just as shootings by idiots who can have access to pump-action shotguns and so on, shoot up a school or a shopping centre or a car park.
Well, thankfully, they haven't been doing that so far in Minnesota. Anyway, there's been riots.
Yes, you would have thought this was in the Deep South where this would happen, whereas Minneapolis in Minnesota is, in American terms, one of the most liberal places in North America.
Anyway, Martin, we've also heard this week federal agents engaged in sex acts with victims. This is a case in Phoenix. Women were forced to live and work in filth and in near darkness. A federal agent said, surviving on only the tips they receive from performing massages and sexual favours. But the case couldn't be pursued because so many of the federal agents had actually been having sex with these women they were supposed to be investigating. It's a different culture, I think, with the police over there. And also, relating to the lockdown, we've seen various protests over there. In Michigan, they had a haircut protest, anti-lockdown demonstrators trade guns for scissors, so they brought scissors instead of guns for the demonstration. Then there was an effigy of a Kentucky governor, Andy Beshear, which was hanged from a tree outside his mansion by Second Amendment supporters, which is a very provocative act, as he's a mixed-race governor. An anti-lockdown demonstrations the husband of Reopen North Carolina leader says he's willing to kill in his fight against the lockdown. This is Adam Smith in the United States. And even actually over in Madrid, there's been anti-lockdown car protests as people get together in their cars. But let's focus on the United States. But what do you make of the way that they've been protesting with guns and et cetera over there and scissors?
Well, I mean, the ongoing culture wars in the United States are very intense. And you can see with the presidential election coming up, it's the things about the lockdown have been totally politicized. So the Democrats tend to want to keep the lockdown going and the Republicans want to lift it. And there's not really much common ground in terms of, scientific advice and, using the presidential bully pulpit to calm nerves. Because, of course, Trump has been encouraging people to take weapons to demonstrations and to protest against Democratic governors and what they're doing. So you can see that with millions of people unemployed now in the US, tens of millions, it's the biggest shock to the system for at least 50 years and probably longer. And you can easily see an armed population descending into civil war. You could. It's not impossible to imagine, is it?
No, it isn't. Interesting. Anyway, so we're going to go and have a listen now to Zara Sultana. She's a Labour MP, and here she uses her maiden speech to bash Tony Blair. I'm not sure if we actually hear her doing that, but it's interesting that there are some Labour MPs who are still very much anti-Blairite. So let's have a listen now to a little part of Zara Sultana. She's a new Labour MP for Coventry, and her maiden speech now.
Cutting our services, underfunding our schools and hospitals, saddling me and my generation with tens of thousands of pounds of student debt. And now the manufacturing jobs that were the backbone of Coventry, that brought my family from Kashmir to the region, are now few and far between. The public libraries that allowed me to study and go to university are closed. The council houses that allowed working class families like mine access safe, affordable homes have been sold off. And while the vast majority have seen services cut and wages stagnate over the past decade, the super rich have had their taxes cut and their incomes soar. The gap between the ruling class and the working class has widened and is widening. And the response from members opposite is, as it always has been, to divide and rule. That's what's happening when they compare Muslim women to bank robbers, when they call gay men tank-topped bum boys, and when they blame events like the Hillsborough disaster on drunken fans. They are pitting our communities against each other. They are diverting attention away from the billionaires that fund their party, dodge their taxes, and rig the economy. Well, Mr. Deputy Speaker, I'm a working-class Muslim woman, and I know the Bullingdon boys will never be on my side. And they will never be on the side of the shop stewards in Coventry, the cleaners in Carlisle, migrant workers in Manchester, or teachers in Tottenham. I know I know my Muslim brothers and sisters, my Jewish comrades, my friends in the Gypsy, Traveller and Roma communities, and people of all faiths and none are safer when we unite to defeat the far right, even as this government has given them newfound confidence. And I know that a government that abandons refugee children abroad will just as quickly abandon working class children in Britain, where one in three already live in poverty. Because this is a government of the few, and it will never be for the many.
So that's Labour MP for Coventry. Her name's Zara Sultana. Martin, she's really actually in another part of that speech, but she's generally talking about Blair and saying, but actually the Blair legacy is a real poison within the Labour Party. And there's also a campaign group of Labour supporters, etc., who's come out just over the last day or so with something called the Open Letter to the Socialist Campaign Group of Labour MPs. And they're very concerned of the drift to the right of the Labour under Keir Starmer. And they're asking for an opposition to the continuation of the anti-Semitism witch hunt, they said. They're aimed at anti-racists and anti- and imperialist supporters of the Palestinians, not anti-Semites. Opposing also, they're asking him to oppose the Board of Deputies' 10 pledges, whose aim is to close down discussion and debate on Palestine and Zionism. And also recognise that Keir Starmer represents the hard right in the Labour Party. I mean, it sounds a little bit like a bit of Labour infighting, but in this open letter, which I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, they also mention the suspension of David Miller, the sociologist at Bristol University, who's an author on this whole subject, a very successful one too.
Well, I think the splits in the Labour Party are hardly they're common knowledge, really. And I in fact voted for Starmer, but I spoke to Fangham, Debonair, our MP. I want him to commit to proportional representation, and I think that's the key thing that would change the atmosphere around all of this.
But why is the Labour Party supporting apartheid Israel now?
Well, that's because there is a right wing of the party, which is more, and many of them have, are members of the Jewish labor movement and have gone to Israel on Israel's ticket. And they are basically opposed by the left wing of the party, which is historically much more favourable to the Palestinians. And of course, that conflict is escalating as we speak because they're annexing land and all the rest of it. But coming back to the British political angle, what ought to happen is that we should have effectively two parties, which is what would be the case in a normal European country. And of course, we wouldn't have a Tory government either, which is another plus. And I think Starmer ought to think quite hard about forming a progressive coalition of all the forces that want to change the direction of the government.
Anyway, look, I'd like Stephen to have some time to comment as well. Stephen, the letter says, in the past week, Professor David Miller, co-author of Bad News for Labour, has also been suspended. His book launch during Labour Party conference was cancelled by Waterstones after the normal volley of abuse and intimidation from Zionists. What do you make of the Israel lobby's influence in British politics?
Well, I wouldn't use that phrase myself. There is a legitimate debate to be had over the occupied territories in Palestine. I've been there three times myself when I was a member of parliament, and I know the issues inside out. But anti-Semitism is a cancer that has afflicted the Labour Party, particularly under Corbyn's leadership, or while Corbyn was leader. It had more free reign, and I welcome the fact that he's gone, and they now have a leader who might want to deal with that.
But I mean, surely the criticism was of Palestine, not of Jews, of the Israeli policy there.
Yeah, and that's where the distinction must always be drawn, that it is perfectly legitimate to criticise the actions of the government of Israel in the same way as it's legitimate to criticise the actions of Donald Trump. But if you catch it in the language that implies you're critical of everyone who happens to live there, or everyone who happens to have the same faith who lives there, or if you're anti-American rather than anti the actions of George W. Bush or Donald Trump, then you're undermining your own case. You're not really helping people at all. But I do welcome what Martin just said about Keir Starmer needing to commit to proportional representation. That's the breakthrough that we need. In all of our lifetimes, the Conservative Party has been in government much more than it ever deserved to be, based on the votes that it got in elections. And that's because the non-conservative forces in British politics, the Labour Party, the Liberal Democrats, nationalist parties in Scotland and Wales, are fragmented. And the first-past-the-post system has enabled Tories to rule for far longer than they ever should have done. The sooner the Labour Party wakes up to that, the better. With what they usually do is think their turn will come eventually, and that's why they set their face against PR. I do hope Keir Starmer's going to change that, but thus far he's not made his position totally clear.
No, he hasn't. Okay, well, thanks very much to our guests. That's former Communities Minister and Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, ex-Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world. So that's U Sound System, Gary Clayle, from, now, which year was that? 1991, Human Nature. Seems like another world, doesn't it? Bristol music going out to the world with a fantastic, very positive and powerful message. Anyway, welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The mark of the beast. And it's British. Who said UK manufacturing was dead? The Covey pass. Who's funding it? And is this Blair and Brown's ID card's second wave? Remember, we campaigned against this with No to ID starting in 2004, thought it was finally killed off in 2010, the National ID card scheme. The COVID pass is what one venture capitalist, Sir Ronald Cohen, thinks we all need. He says the cost to governments of his COVID pass to let us back into pubs will be tiny compared to the $350 billion being lost every month in lack of manufacturing in the US alone. Plus vaccines, the great TV debate we haven't yet seen between Bill Gates and an actual doctor, British anti-vaccine physician Dr. Andrew Wakefield. We don't have that, I'm afraid. It'd be really lovely to see it, but we don't have that here. I don't know if it's ever going to happen. It'd be lovely to see it. It's the obvious thing for a producer or a journalist to do. But we do have something called The Truth About Vaccines from the US group. Second best, I'm afraid. And a cameo appearance from Dr. Wakefield on health risks of the COVID-19 vaccine from his new home in California, asking if we've learned anything at all from the Nazi experiments on humans. That's Andrew Wakefield asking that. And also, in the wider picture, Meng Wanzhou. Remember her? China's Huawei's chief financial officer. She's currently under house arrest in Vancouver, Canada. But she was arrested 18 months ago in December 2018 under American orders. Every time the US moves closer to extraditing her, China moves against Hong Kong and America's allies in the region, it seems. And also related, perhaps, to a troop movements in Asia, in India and China. What's going on there? And also China's mission to Mars and America's attempt to privatize space. So, Martin, let's start, I think, by going to one of the last things I was talking about there, which is Meng Wanzhou. A lot of people have forgotten about this arrest of Huawei's chief financial officer, but it is actually, many people would argue, and I certainly would argue, that this is what has really sparked some of the real political tensions in China, particularly those in Hong Kong, because the government has been attempting, the Chinese Communist Party, to do similar sorts of extraditions from Hong Kong into mainland China, as America is attempting to do, in this case, from Canada into the US.
Well, the tensions are obviously palpable on every level, and obviously she was arrested some time ago.
18 months ago, yeah.
Well, before all of the tensions that have blown up around the pandemic. And it may be the case, as you say, that the Chinese wanting to extradite people from Hong Kong was related to her arrest. But of course, the central government in China have backed down on extradition from Hong Kong, but protests have continued because there's no real trust on the ground in Hong Kong for the central government. They for their part are taking a rather hard line because they feel as if they're being pushed into a corner by Trump, and that they can't afford to be too liberal about it all. Not to put too fine a point on it. So the dangers are palpable in Hong Kong itself. If they've got any sense, the Chinese central government will not intervene too much. What's actually beginning to happen, of course, is the economy in Hong Kong is going down the drain. And I don't think that if they are wise, the central government will just let that happen. They'll say, you don't want to be part of China. Fine, we're not going to bail you out. And you can't, you can just stew in your own juice. And then ultimately some kind of compromise might be achieved. But it's going to be very difficult because it's quite possible, just by accident, that some kind of shooting war is going to start, in which case the Chinese People's Liberation Army will take over Hong Kong in an afternoon.
A US destroyer has been sailing around near China-claimed islands, adding to mounting tensions. The US relations with China, this is Jason Ditz on antiwar.com, are being called the worst in 40 years, an ever-growing litany of reasons why. From the US blaming China for coronavirus to US hostility towards Chinese telecom company Huawei. One of the most dangerous devices on territorial claims, where the US has been challenging Chinese maritime claims in the South China Sea, usually doing so with deliberate naval confrontation, sending warships close maritime challenges resulted in harsh rhetoric in the past, but this week the USS Martin, a guided missile destroyer, sailed right next to two Chinese-claimed parasol islands, Woody Island and Pyramid Rock. No direct confrontation, but Martin, this sort of thing doesn't necessarily help the situation.
No, it doesn't. And if you put the shoe on the other foot, what would the Royal Navy do if the Chinese Navy insisted on steaming up and down the channel? They can, because it's an open water, but they would definitely be following them around and saying, what are you doing here?
But yeah, or maybe around the Solent, you know, next to Portsmouth or something.
Well, indeed, like. Indeed. And of course, these artificial islands or whatever they are, the Spratlys, the Chinese, from their point of view, they're pursuing a defensive strategy, which is there are lots and lots of imports and exports that China makes, including lots of oil, comes through the South China Sea to the major cities on the coast of China. Now, from their point of view, making sure that anybody can come into that area is quite important. But they don't want other people's warships in that area, unless by agreement. I mean, you remember the fuss there was when the Russian aircraft carrier went through the channel. I mean, it's the only place it has to go through somewhere if it's going to go anywhere. But of course, it caused all sorts of ructions. And both in Russia and on the coast of China, NATO and the British, and don't forget a British frigate was involved in this task force sent to arrest Maduro, supposedly for drug dealing. And of course, one good thing this week is it looks like the Iranian tankers, which were taking oil to Venezuela, have mostly gone through the US blockade without being stopped. Probably because if they were stopped and there was a problem, then everything would have escalated straight away over the top. Now, underlying all of this, of course, is the pandemic. And it kind of, and as I've mentioned on before, and of course, the YouTube of our show, which I mentioned, this was the one that YouTube took down. The Israeli Defense Forces had a warning from NATO about a pandemic coming from China in November. And that is courtesy of the Times of Israel. That's a pretty interesting straw in the wind. And coming, I've just mentioned finally, coming back to what Steve Williams was saying earlier about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, rather disappointed by that. Most of the people who are being victimised here are consistent anti-racists, and they're being basically picked on, like David Miller, because they won't toe the line on Israel's annexations and aggressions.
I mean, it does
they bomb Syria consistently.
It does rather suggest that there may be a war in the pipeline, and that we are supposed to be unswervingly on Israel's side in that war.
Well, indeed, and all of these things are coming to a head. As you know, if what may have happened, I mean, we've discussed this in the past. There are a number of possibilities. This either was a naturally derived virus, or it's escaped somehow from either the Wuhan laboratory or another laboratory, possibly Fort Detrick in the US, which was closed down last June. Or it's a deliberate biological warfare attack, which the Chinese have thwarted by pursuing the anti-biological warfare techniques which they've been training for. But of course, if they knew it was an attack on them, they are not necessarily going to tell the Americans that they know. They're just going to make their preparations to get their not to get mad, but to get even. That's how dangerous this all is.
Okay, some more stories on China. US could conduct nuclear tests in months, one of the Pentagon officials says. Well, there's supposed to be a nuclear test ban treaty, but apparently the Americans think it's necessary.
Well, they've also said that the Russians and the Chinese have carried out secret tests, although they've not presented any evidence about that. They're withdrawing from all the nuclear treaties that they've signed with the Russians. But that's because they want to surround China with short-range missiles. And the Chinese basically, I mean, what would the Americans do if the Chinese surrounded the Americans with short-range missiles? And they say, well, this is just a deterrent, you know. And of course, they don't perceive it like that. And the danger here is miscalculation, just as in the run-up to World War One. Everybody followed the playbook that they were following, and it eventually led to a conflagration.
I mean, this whole idea...
They've just talked themselves into it.
This whole idea of having a nuclear test Well, one would have thought that that's not going to necessarily be necessary in order to see if their nuclear weapons work. I think they do work. But of course, it sends a very clear message, doesn't it? Look what we can do to you, China.
Yes. And of course, the others, I think both the Russians and the Chinese, the Chinese have only got about 300 nuclear warheads. The Russians and the Americans have got thousands and thousands between them. So the Chinese quite rightly say, you can't involve us in discussions about reducing nuclear weapons. We've got the bare minimum. And it's quite, you know, they're developing nuclear, they're developing missile technology and submarine technology to deliver their warheads. But they're not trying to get loads more. There's no point. I mean, yeah, you know, even a fraction of those warheads will be enough to do the job, thinking. Yeah.
Surely the US military thinking is very much like it was in the 1960s with Russia, is we're so far ahead of China with nuclear weapons that if we attack them now, we can win.
Well, they do talk about in that sort of way, madly enough. But the Chinese have always taken the view, and I think quite rightly, if you nuke us, we will nuke you back. And that's all you need to be able to do. But of course, NATO doctrine, US doctrine, British doctrine has always been that we might use them first. Both Chinese Communist Party doctrine and current Russian military doctrine is that we're never going to use them first. But if you use them at all, then we're going all out and we're going to nuke you.
Yes, but how much does the Pentagon really care about its US cities and its own citizens?
Well, they've war gamed things where they're going to have we kill millions of them and somehow somebody's won. They still do that. Absolutely bonkers as it is. And of course, nobody's going to win. It's pretty clear. I mean, the latest missiles, not super duper missiles, as Trump refers to what they're going to do. They're called hypersonic missiles and they can hit anything on planet Earth within 25 minutes. So they can wipe out, basically, for example, an attacking naval task force in the South China Sea. That's not even using nuclear weapons.
Also, there is another headline relating to China, which is COVID preps military for war with China and Russia. This is US military is using its new data collection system designed for war in the response to the pandemic. Pentagon sees the new JADC2 system as vital for beating China and Russia in military confrontations. US Northern Command is using a new data collection system to track the spread of COVID-19. Joint All Domain Command and Control, JADC2, is a project in its infancy designed to collect information on all aspects of military operations using artificial intelligence. Data to be shared between all branches. The idea is to connect every piece of military hardware to the network. But another aim of JADC2 is to give commanders the ability to swap out weapons in the middle of a war, meaning commanders will be able to simultaneously control every tool on the battlefield, making it harder for enemies to prioritize defense. But this is being rolled out as a potential, well, it's being used now by the military as a way to respond to the pandemic. But actually, it sounds to me, Martin, like a little bit of software to turn the battlefield into some sort of wargaming platform where you can drag and drop bits and pieces around the battlefield.
Well, I mean, you can imagine that the high-level militaries are engaged in this kind of use of artificial intelligence to try and up their game. Underlying all of this is, I mean, the biological warfare aspects of this are fascinating, in the sense that the Chinese had attacks on their pig herd and their chicken flock, and then this pandemic comes along. They're beginning to wonder if they're basically being targeted by this. Incidentally, it's quite clear that Porton Down and all the other biological warfare facilities in the West were not looking into how to protect against biological warfare. Otherwise, we'd have had a completely different response to the pandemic than the one we've had. In Bulgaria, they've had quite a good COVID war, but that's because they just dusted down the old Warsaw Pact. We're under attack biologically. What do we do? I think that the West's biological warfare program is fundamentally offensive and not defensive. That's pretty clear. And the rest of the world is getting pretty fed up with the arrogant and bloodthirsty attitude of the ruling oligarchy in the West.
Okay, so anyway, let's move on to look at the whole case of Julian Assange now. It's been kicked into the long grass until the autumn, as I understand, Martin. So it, again, a little bit like Meng Wanzhou, you know, you've got a case for extradition where the person is left in limbo. It's almost like you're arrested at the airport and you're stuck in a room for 18 months while they decide what to do with you. This is where Julian Assange is. And many have compared the whole house arrest of Julian Assange to the this whole idea of the lockdown, where particularly vulnerable people have had to spend weeks and weeks and weeks in their homes, obviously for different reasons, but it's a similar experience for them. But anyway, I thought we'd have a listen now to Andrew Feinstein. He's a former ANC MP in South Africa, who's also the author of The Shadow World Inside the Global Arms Trade. And here is his take on some of the comparisons between the Assange case and what his experience was of apartheid South Africa.
Just listening to the other speakers so far, in particular to Craig's description of the court process, quite honestly reminds me of the farcical legal processes that we used to endure under apartheid, where you had this impression sitting in a court of law that this was all theatre that was being enacted to try and give the impression of due legal process, where it has already been decided that there shall be no due legal process. And it really concerns me that this is happening in the United Kingdom of today. But I suppose taking the sort of context that Chris Williamson has outlined, we shouldn't be surprised. And why do I say that? Well, I know most of you who are on this call will realize this, but perhaps to some of you coming to this issue more recently, let us just reiterate what Julian Assange is being persecuted for. He's being persecuted for revealing the crimes of the US government and its allies, primarily the US's biggest poodle when it comes to military matters, the United Kingdom. He is being prosecuted for speaking truth to power. And if we are not able to stop this corrupt and illegal process that is currently carrying on, we would not just have failed an individual in Julian. We would have failed the task of truth-telling, the task of journalism, the task of holding power to account. We will also have abandoned the right of every citizen to know what our government is doing in our name and with our money. We should also bear in mind that what Julian has done is he has violated the sanctified code of the national security state. And what do I mean by that? Everything that happens in the domain of national security is hidden behind a veil of national security imposed secrecy. So we look at the specific crimes that Julian and WikiLeaks have revealed, but we remind ourselves that every day similar crimes are happening using primarily American and British weapons to murder innocent civilians in Yemen. As Chris Hedges, the former New York Times war correspondent who was fired for publicly opposing the invasion of Iraq, has said, if citizens were actually shown the true images of the conflicts that we are engaged in, the conflicts that we are providing the weapons and the financing for, if we could see those real images, if we could read the real reports of what was happening in those wars, we as citizens would not allow this to happen in our name. So what Julian and WikiLeaks have done is to bypass that sanctity of national security imposed secrecy and to reveal to us citizens what is really being done in our name. And I should just mention, based on my research over the past 20 years, that it is not just the murder and mayhem of war making that is being hidden from us here. it is worth bearing in mind that the global trade in weapons accounts for 40% of all corruption in all world trade. And who benefits from that corruption? Corruption that, for instance, saw the United Kingdom pay members of the Saudi royal family, the son of Margaret Thatcher, Mark Thatcher, and numerous intermediaries, £6 billion in bribes. Who benefits from these bribes? It is politicians, corporate executives, and intermediaries such as arms dealers, banks, auditors, consultants, and lawyers. They make fortunes out of the arms trade and out of our war making. And it is this bribery and corruption that oils the wheels of our corrupted political processes. When one considers the nature of the power of the national security state, one can feel extremely daunted. When one hears the accounts of what is happening in court when Julian appears, one can feel incredibly depressed and powerless. It's a feeling that many people in South Africa grew up with during the worst years of apartheid. And some of us think that as we got towards 1994, when apartheid finally came to an end, that the 10 years previously were probably a time in which we saw a loosening of this, what was effectively an authoritarian, reactionary, racist oligarchy. But in fact, it was the years leading up to the end of apartheid that were amongst the worst to endure for the majority of South Africans. Because as the apartheid state claimed that it was starting a process of reform, in the African townships of the country, it imposed even worse repression than had been seen historically. But it never resulted in people on the ground in South Africa and in the international anti-apartheid movement losing hope. At a slightly anecdotal and personal level, I was forced to leave South Africa in the mid-1980s because I'd become involved with the then banned ANC from my late teens, and I was due to be called up for service in the apartheid military. I was taken out of the country, very fortunately. And the night before I was leaving the country at very short notice, I remember sitting above the city of Cape Town, my hometown, and what I, in a probably prejudiced way, regard as one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And I remember thinking to myself that I will never again in my lifetime see this city. Because if anybody had told me in 1986 that 4 years later, the ANC would be unbanned, Nelson Mandela would be released from prison, and 4 years after that, Mandela would actually be elected as a democratically elected president of South Africa, I would have seriously questioned their mental health at the time. But the reality is that that is what happened. And it happened as a consequence of an extraordinary international anti-apartheid campaign and the vast majority of South Africans making their own country ungovernable for the authoritarian regime that tried to rule over them. And it's at times like these, when things feel as bleak as they do today in global politics, in the case of Julian Assange, in the really pathetic role that our mainstream media is playing in propping up the status quo, that we should remember these experiences of hope, these experiences of triumph. For if we allow the national security state to continue to do as it pleases, we, all of humanity, will enable the political and economic elite to destroy our planet, to make us far less safe, and to make our world far less democratic. So for all of us who've joined this call, there are crucial things that we can do. We can spread information to as many people as we can about what Julian Assange and WikiLeaks have actually done, which has been a remarkable service to humanity. We can spread information about the nature of the court case and about why Britain is kowtowing to the needs of America in this particular case. Because that is the most powerful thing we have, is the power of information. And it is up to all of us who've been a part of this call to spread that information as widely as we possibly can, so that we can ultimately free Julian Assange, free the truth, and free ourselves from the national security state. Thank you very much.
So that's the former ANC Member of Parliament and anti-apartheid activist, Andrew Feinstein there. He's also the author of The Shadow World, Inside the Global Arms Trade, a bit of a friend of this programme. He's been on several times over the years, Martin. But he's making these very important points about fighting apartheid and authoritarianism. What do you think the connection is between the South African apartheid and what's been going on with Julian Assange? And you might possibly wish to bring in the racism of the Israeli state.
Well, Assange obviously is it's a key case. I can't see that there's any case in English common law for him to answer. And the fact that he's being held in solitary confinement as if he was an international terrorist in Belmarsh prison is an absolute stain on the reputation of this country.
He may have been taken out of Belmarsh now, actually.
Well, at the same time, he shouldn't be in prison at all. I know, if you remember all the years that he was hiding out in the Ecuadorian embassy, the usual suspects, the Daily Mail, etc., were saying he didn't have anything to fear. He should just come out and have to face these allegations of rape from Sweden, which were never actually turned into a proper extradition request and were ultimately dismissed. And then when he didn't come out, they went in and got him, and he's being tried in a British court under the U.S. Espionage Act, which isn't British law, it's US law. And it was created in the US initially to smash the opposition to the First World War. And it's had a very, very controversial history. It led to the imprisonment of Eugene Debs, who is the leader of the Socialist Party in the US in 1917. And Bill Hayward, who was the leader of the Industrial Workers of the World, fled to Russia to avoid being imprisoned under the Espionage Act. It's essentially an undemocratic act of repression, and it's not it's very rarely used, but it's being used against Julian Assange in a British court. What's that? And of course, he's not either a British citizen or a US citizen. And of course, what the US are now trying to do is make their courts superior to other people's courts around the world. So in the run-up to this attempted coup in Venezuela, the courts in New York decided that Maduro was a narco-terrorist, and they issued a warrant for his arrest, which was then, of course, the basis for this completely illegal armed intervention. In Argentina, the government did a deal with its creditors to settle, some money would be paid, but most of it would be written off. Peter Singer, big supporter of the Republican Party, he bought up loads of Argentinian debt for pennies. He then took it all. He then took a court case out in New York saying that the debt said, you owe me millions. And the court said, oh, yes, you are owed millions. And then the Argentinians were told that all the deals they'd done to reduce their debts were all over. They got to pay all of it 100% because a court in New York has decided that they owed the money. And, of course, they're going to do the same sort of thing with the Chinese. They're going to say, oh, well, you started COVID-19. So all the money that we say you say we owe you, because, of course, the Chinese are owed loads and loads of dollars, we're not going to pay you. And we're also going to potentially impound your merchant ships, because the Chinese have got a massive merchant navy. All of which is totally unacceptable. It's not legal. It's about as legal as Hitler's invasion of Poland.
But now, Belmarsh, The Belmarsh Supermax prison where Assange has been held, he's still there apparently, is regarded as UK's version of the American facility at Guantanamo Bay. Beside Assange, the jail is home to mafia henchmen, Al-Qaeda members and neo-fascist enforcers. It was anyway, like Tommy Robinson. 20% of prisoners in Belmarsh are murderers and two-thirds have committed violent crimes. So it's even possible something might happen to him while he's in there, Martin, with all these people.
Well, interestingly enough, he was allowed out of solitary confinement eventually because the other prisoners, including the murderers, etc., said that's uncruel and unusual. And they were approaching the governor and saying, let him out and come and let him socialise with us. It's not fair, you're keeping him in solitary confinement. And that's when his solitary confinement was finally released. But let's get to the bottom of this. He shouldn't be there. It's as simple as that. This is an absolute outrage to British justice.
And he's confined in a glass cage.
Well, in other words, they're not even allowing the public to see how this court case is being conducted. The magistrate in charge, her husband's got links to the military-industrial complex and the Tory party, all of which should basically have the liberal opinion in this country up in arms. But of course, it doesn't, because in actual fact, they're all bought and paid for. The Guardian is not doing leader articles on why this is outrageous. It's not becoming the Dreyfus affair, which it should be.
Yes, that is peculiar, Martin. Maybe we can dwell on that for a second, because Julian Assange and WikiLeaks were feeding massive exclusives to the Guardian newspaper for years.
Yes, and they used them. And then what happened was various people who were involved with that then decided to ditch Assange. And as you're probably aware, many of our listeners will be aware, the Guardian is in fact certainly the foreign affairs section is basically run by MI6, which is why they have all this tear-jerking stuff about the white helmets rescuing babies in Syria, even though in actual fact they're the ones who are working with Al-Qaeda to kill babies at our expense. And, of course, Julian Assange exposed all of this sort of stuff, and that's why he's in prison, and they're where they are, making money out of it all.
Also this week, FBI search warrants have revealed that Trump's aides' messages to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The FBI search warrants reveal that Trump campaigner Roger Stone sent private messages to WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange after the site published thousands of documents that damaged Hillary Clinton's election campaign. This is by Bill Goodwin in Computer Weekly. And this was from a couple of weeks ago. He's a strategist and associate of US President Donald Trump. And he was exchanging private messages with Assange. So obviously the guy is known to Donald Trump, although he seems to be shrugging his shoulders now. I've never heard of WikiLeaks.
Well, that's right. I mean, what that's about is about the so-called hacking of the Democratic National Committee computers. Now, what that showed is that the primary primary setup in the Democratic Party was basically being rigged. And nobody disputes that. It was rigged. But the Democratic establishment then said, but that just makes us look bad, and therefore it must be the Russians that hacked in to make us look bad, although completely skating over the fact that the emails make you look bad because you're bad. You rigged it. It wasn't the Russians who were rigging the primary process.
Look, Martin, one place where Julian Assange still is making headlines is guess where?
Well, Australia, I would hope.
You're absolutely right. And in Australia, the headlines literally 2 days ago, UK is endangering Assange's life by imprisoning him. Says his partner. So, I mean, this is it possible he's going to end up like Slobodan Milosevic at the International Criminal Court, who died whilst he was being so-called put on trial?
Well, he's clearly been persecuted, in a very, very severe way, and his health isn't good. And so if he did die, it wouldn't be a surprise, would it? And then, of course, that's problem solved from the point of view of the establishment are doing this to intimidate others. That's why they're doing it. It's not just about
him.
Well,
wasn't it Joseph Stalin? You've quoted this to me before. It says, no person, no problem.
Yes, it is Stalin who said that. And he also said, the only unity of opinion is in the graveyard. I mean, he didn't quite mean it like that. He was trying to, at the time, pretend to be a liberal. But of course, he certainly went to town on that as a philosophy.
Okay,
but the point about Julian Assange, this should be, it shouldn't even be a political issue. Everybody, somebody like David Davis, who claims to be in favour of human rights, this is wrong. And if we don't draw the line here, you are basically opening the door to totalitarianism. There's no doubt.
And also, I mean, there is a ray of hope from what Andrew Feinstein was saying, that he would think that if anyone thought that there was going to be black majority rule in South Africa, he would think of them as a mad person. But actually, it does get to a point where things can really change, can't they?
It does. But there's a difference between hope and expectation. The situation has got worse and worse since 9/11, since the collapse of the banks in 2008. You know, since the invasion of Iraq, since the collapse of Syria under Western and jihadi assault, you know, anybody who thinks there's going to be a business as usual once we get out of the pandemic is deluded. We nearly
anyway, look, it's business as usual within the pandemic, because this week India and China have been moving more troops into the border region, according to Bloomberg.com. Trump has tweeted an offer to mediate between the two nations. I'm not sure if either of them are going to take that one up. And China's move matches its actions in the South China Sea, so Bloomberg says. Anyway, India has moved additional troops along its northern border as it prepares for an extended conflict with its neighbour. China, after several rounds of talks, failed to ease tensions. China's already placed 5,000 extra soldiers and armoured vehicles within its side of the disputed border in the Ladakh region.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that the explanation for that, in my mind, is that the Americans are going for a maximum pressure strategy on China. So Modi, who is himself effectively a neo-fascist murderer, is being encouraged to pick a fight with the Chinese just to keep them, you know, they're basically, you know, the people in Hong Kong are being encouraged to protest. Uyghurs in the northwest province of China are being encouraged to rise up. The Indians are being encouraged to put pressure on China from that direction. Trump is threatening to sue them for COVID. The trade deal is off. At a certain point, if you push people to their backs to the wall, they may lash out. And of course, what a Chinese general this week was saying, well, we're not necessarily going to reunite Taiwan without fighting. If necessary, we will invade Taiwan. So they feel that they've got to make threats back, because threats are being made to them. And it's a pretty dangerous situation.
Okay, well, anyway, let's go on now to look at this so-called mark of the beast. This is called the COVID pass. The idea is, genius idea, that you get a little digital ID certificate, either as some kind of on some sort of microchip on a card that you carry around with you, a sort of ID card that you carry everywhere, which will allow you to go into pubs and things like this and not to have to do any of this social distancing, which is so irritating for many people. And maybe, for example, to not have to wear a mask, that kind of thing. The virus apparently is on the way out. So why is this being introduced, some might ask? The passport linked to health status is discriminatory and should be illegal, some are saying. Anyway, the biometric update is the website where I found this, Martin. The question, of course, has got to be, who is funding this? And it's actually a website all about the COVID pass, and it's being funded by a chap called Sir Ronald Cohen. He turns out to be a staunch Blairite and funder of the Labour Party. So he is, it seems, very political. But anyway, Martin, before we talk about him, what do you make of this whole idea of having a digital ID in order to get back to normal? And if you don't have it, you're going to have the social distance indefinitely.
Well, I think the first point to make is all based on the idea that there will be a vaccine, and it's quite possible that there won't be. So in which case, why bother to develop all these techniques for working out who's been vaccinated for a vaccine that doesn't exist? What might be possible is, if you've got tested people and you've tested that they're COVID-free or they've got antibodies, then they should be able to socialise. And of course, you've then got to find some mechanism for identifying who those people are. But of course, there's a desire to control the population anyway, whether digitally or otherwise. and that is the and also there's a desire to make money out of selling vaccines.
I mean, surely you don't want to control your population too much, otherwise they'll think they're living in a police state and they won't want to fight any wars for you.
Well, I think the we're already under virtually 24-hour surveillance anyway. So, you know, there's people kind of freaking out about the fact that they might be chipped. They're largely missing the point. You're already under surveillance. Everything we do these days means you're trackable by electronic means. And we know because Snowden told us that they've been collecting. It's not legal. It's illegal, but they've been doing it. It's even in the US Constitution.
Let's have a look at the guy that's funding the COVID chip. He's called Sir Ronald Cohen. He's a very political figure as well as being an investment fund manager. In 1974, he stood as the parliamentary candidate for the Liberal Party in Kensington North. In 1979, he stood as its European candidate in London West. So he's been in the EU elections and the UK parliamentary elections as a Liberal candidate, but in 96 he switched allegiance to the Labour Party just before Tony Blair, and I suppose after Mo Mowlam and her prawn cocktail offensive got the City of London behind the Labour Party, he jumped on board, becoming a supporter of Tony Blair. In 2004 he was the Labour Party's fourth largest financial supporter after Lord Sainsbury, Sir Christopher Gnatty and Lord Hamlin. So he's up there with the big boys, Martin, the Blairites supporting the Labour Party, who joined up with the Labour Party after the prawn cocktail offensive. I mean, can you tell us a bit about who you know, what people like him and who they are?
Well, the prawn cocktail offensive wasn't Mo Mowlam, it was John Smith. But the general gist of what you're saying is true. I mean, at one stage, Blair's stated policy was to get the Labour Party funded by big business figures so that he was liberated from having to negotiate with the trade unions, because up to that point the trade unions had been the main source of funds for the Labour Party, and of course that meant they had quite a big say in what the policy.
He's got a point there, hasn't he? Surely these big financiers are easier to chat to than the unions.
Well, they are, and of course the kind of things they're asking for are more amenable to what Tony Blair wanted to do. So that's why he was manoeuvring in that direction. Ultimately, follow the money in politics. That explains quite a lot. I mean, that's, you know, in Norway, for example, political parties are funded on the basis by the state on the basis of what their last showing in the last election was.
Anyway, look, Sir Ronald
that's
Cohen.
Not the case here.
Sir Ronald Cohen talks about himself, Kobe Pass Man, I call him. Sir Ronald Cohen. He talks about himself as an ethical investor. So let's have a listen to him and see, Martin, when he finishes, let's hear your reaction to whether you think he is or not.
The first social investment bank in the UK, which I was privileged to co-found with Nick O'Donoghue, funded by bank account money that had been separated from its owners for 15 years or more. And just stayed on the balance sheets of the banks. That money was released, and with $1 billion worth of money, we created the Social Investment Bank and began to bring investment to not-for-profits. And then the G8 experience, where Matt was a very loyal partner and active partner, where we began to create boards in each of the leading industrialized countries of the world and get feedback on what was going on with social issues in these countries. And it was then that the light bulb, a second light bulb, came on after the social impact bond light bulb. And that light bulb was, you know what? Values are changing. Young people want more meaning than just making money. They want to be able to impact favorably the lives of other people. Young people connect with others in far away countries. They identify with them. And perhaps they understand that they're going to inherit a very problematic planet if nothing is done now.
So that is Sir Ronald Cohen, the man behind the COVID pass, the ID 2020 proposal, which is being looked at all around the world at the moment. And he's put a lot of money into developing that, marketing it, Martin, and actually saying to governments, well, you get my COVID pass and it's going to help you get out of this rather sticky situation, help your population get back to work.
Well, as I said, I think we've said what we need to say about the COVID pass. There isn't a vaccine yet, so there's not much point having a pass unless you've got a vaccine. I think on the general points he's making there, it's what you might call caring capitalism, which is very much the sort of thing that Blair thought he was into. I mean, I used to be social economy officer, development officer at Bristol City Council, and there's nothing wrong with building up a third sector of enterprises which are not for profit and have non-traditional goals like, you know, inclusion or sustainability or whatever. The problem is it's over-egged.
And I mean, Bristol Energy was one of these, not for profit.
So in other words, they may end up making no money at all, in which case, what's the point of them? Or they end up not actually tackling the problems they really need to tackle. So, for example, what we really need to do is we shouldn't have privatized the energy industry. And then we would be able to have the government be able to decide what strategy it wanted to pursue in relation to all sorts of things, climate change, inclusion.
Renationalize it, so, yeah?
Well, I mean, renationalize it. What they did in Venezuela with these things is what you do is you regulate the existing utilities to the point where they can't make money and their share price has basically gone down to zero. And then you buy it off them for nothing.
That sounds like a brilliant plan. Okay, anyway, let's have a listen now to some clips about the from the documentary The Truth About Vaccines. And we start, first of all, this is a US documentary with one where they look at the potential, and this is a very recent one, so it's been made after the beginning of the lockdown, about you possibly having your kids taken away.
Check out this shocking video clip from Dr. Michael Ryan from the World Health Organization, who leads the team responsible for treating COVID-19.
In most parts of the world, due to lockdown, most of the transmission that's actually happening in many countries now is happening in the household, at family level. In some senses, transmission has been taken off the streets and pushed back into family units. Now we need to go and look in families to find those people who may be sick and remove them and isolate them in a safe and dignified manner.
Just so you know, we're coming to your house, seizing your children, removing them from the house by force, and isolating them in a safe and dignified manner. I don't think so, Dr. Ryan. That may work in the UK, but you try that in the USA, and you're going to find out that the majority of us still believe wholeheartedly in all the amendments listed in the Bill of Rights.
Sadly, the United States Constitution really doesn't seem to matter anymore. According to Dr. Ron Paul, what is most dangerous throughout this coronavirus pandemic is that although this virus will eventually disappear, the assault on our civil liberties is not likely to be reversed.
So that's a clip there from The Truth About Vaccines. A bit scary, Martin, isn't it? The idea of people coming in and saying, oh, you've got a sick child, we're going to take him away now. Because the children generally tend to get very, very mild symptoms.
Well, I mean, if you look at the contact and trace regime in South Korea, I won't bring in China because they treat it as a biological warfare attack. They basically didn't have a full on lockdown, but that's because everybody who they thought had got it, they checked everybody that they'd spoken to. So, for example, they were able to identify the individual that went to various gay bars in Seoul and infected loads of people, you know, presumably by, getting up close and friendly with them. And they traced all of those people and they were then all.
I mean, it might be they're saying there, aren't they, that it might happen in Britain, but it's likely to meet with rather more resistance in the US. Anyway, well,
as we said earlier, there could easily be a civil war in the US.
So anyway, the next clip from it is about some fake news footage which was spotted by these American documentary makers on Channel 4.
We'll address the coronavirus vaccine more in a moment, But first, we wanted to address some of the potential misinformation about COVID-19, coronavirus, which has drastically affected the way we live our daily lives here in the United States and across the globe.
Much of the USA and the world is in lockdown, self-quarantine, and previously jam-packed places like Grand Central Station, which used to see millions of visitors a day, and airports, which were previously bustling, are now virtually empty, with thousands of flights being canceled every day. Basically, coronavirus has created a bunch of ghost towns.
We already showed you in episode 8 how the mainstream media tends to be all in the same script. So, is it possible that they are all on the same script with COVID-19?
For example, toward the end of March, when New York City became the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak, in the United States at least, Governor Cuomo was calling for more ventilators and more hospital beds, since he said it had become a war zone in New York City. On multiple channels, we were shown this footage, which appeared to be of a semi-busy ICU at New York City in a hospital.
However, we soon discovered that it wasn't actually New York City. That was footage previously shown by Sky News of Italy on March 22nd, 3 days before.
Check it out. You can see the CBS broadcast of March 25th on the top and the Sky News broadcast of March 22nd on the bottom. Same footage. And by ICU standards, not really all that busy.
Yeah, so that's a little clip from the documentary. But I also think it's be quite useful to listen, as I mentioned at the top of the hour, to Dr. Andrew Wakefield. And he's concerned about some of the ideas that are circulating about mandatory vaccines. And he starts really by talking about what did we actually learn anything from Nazi Germany? I mean, let's hear what you think, whether he's exaggerating. And this is the so-called discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield, but at least he's a medical doctor, which Bill Gates is not.
Now they've taken that right away from the children's doctor, the person who knows these children, and put it in the hands of a state official who's never met them, doesn't know them, and frankly doesn't care. So there is a dramatic limitation of medical exemptions in order to exert control over vaccination policy. It's catastrophic. There is no place whatsoever in medicine for any mandated procedure. None. Zero. And Nazi Germany taught us that. Experimental medical programs in people who did not have informed consent is abhorrent, is totally unacceptable to the conduct of ethical medicine. You can't do it. You must never do it. But that's what's happening here in California. People are being forced into a medical procedure with known risks, with quantifiable risks, where they have to pick up the consequences of a permanently damaged child. No one cares. There's nothing there for them, no infrastructure in place to protect that family. They bear all the liability. So when that child, that parent, hands their baby over to the doctor to be vaccinated, then the least informed person in that relationship, because you can't sue the doctor, you can't sue the pharmaceutical companies, the least informed person bears all the liability and all the risk, the mother. And that's atrocious. And so there is no place whatsoever for mandated medical procedures in any civilized country in the world. And that is what is happening here and what they intend for the world. And it's got to stop.
So that's Dr. Andrew Wakefield, the discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield. We've got a minute or so to discuss that, Martin. What do you make of his linking this to Nazi claims of experimentation on human beings in Nazi Germany, saying actually nobody should be mandated, it all should be done under informed consent?
Well, I'm generally of the opinion that things should be done under informed consent. You know, bringing Hitler into any argument is, you know, an emotive way to argue. I think there's lots of cases to answer about the vaccination industry and all the rest of it. It clearly is a racket. And I think that, you know, RFK Jr.'s investigations of it have demonstrated that it is. And what we need to have is a genuinely public healthcare system, including publicly owned pharmaceutical companies, and that's what they want in the developing world as well. They want to be able to produce basic vaccines and basic goods without having to pay patents to the big pharma industry. But to say that always things should always be dealt with by informed consent. I think that's in general that's correct.
Yeah, but the thing is, it should be the patient's choice rather than. But I mean, of course, they may actually just simply use coercion, make people's lives as difficult as possible.
Well, yeah, but
also, so eventually they
also
do.
There is a case. I mean, the best way to do it is, of course, to persuade people that it's in their interests and that the people who are asking you to do this are doing it because they've got your interests at heart. But of course, that's very hard to do when we've got an oligarchic run system, which is basically run. I mean, it's quite clear that the pharmaceutical companies are not looking to cure things. They're looking to create situations of ongoing illness, which allow them to carry on making money.
So anyway, that documentary is part 9 of the, they call it a documentary series. It's called The Truth About Vaccines. And I'll put up a link to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And I look forward to the live TV debate streamed and watched on television around the world between Dr. Andrew Wakefield and plain old Bill Gates. So anyway, thanks to our guest in the first hour, former Communities Minister, Lib Dem MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, and comment page and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. You can hear Danny Lopsch on Sunday evening at 7. BCFM boss Pat Hart did say our sister show Dialect would be on BCFM every Monday, but it hasn't appeared so far. You'll certainly find this and Dialect online at thisweek.org.uk. We'll be back on FM soon. Pat Hart winning. Do please join us for our politics show live stream at the old time of 5 o'clock. Until 7 next Friday, God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.